Okay, well, thank you, Robert. Appreciate the invitation to speak and share my perspective. My training is in cell biology, so what I have to say is a little more personal reflections and just kind of some thoughts about methodological naturalism. Now, I don't first recall when I heard the term methodological naturalism, but I do remember a great sense of relief washing over me. I was a young graduate student working in a lab of about a dozen people from about a dozen different countries, and many had religious and philosophical outlooks very different from my own. Yet we all worked as a team to study the role of the cell's internal scaffold, the cytoskeleton, in the process. Sorry? You can't hear? Okay. Okay. So I was just saying that my early training in graduate school, I was working in a cell biology lab with people from all different religious perspectives and philosophical outlooks, and yet we all functioned very well as a team to study science. Now, before I understood this distinction between the philosophical naturalism and methodological naturalism, I had two recurring concerns. First, I feared that somehow I was neglecting God in my work, because despite an active attempt to do my work unto the Lord, I couldn't seem to capture anything in my calculations or discoveries in science. And second, the atheistic and agnostic scientists around me seemed to be discovering real facts about nature. Now, this latter observation bothered me because, having grown up in the Bible Belt, I had spent time with Christian brothers and sisters who pretty much shunned all music and literature and educational styles that weren't explicitly Christian. And while my family didn't do this and my church didn't advocate it, as I can recall, I somehow internalized the belief that the work and thinking of unbelievers was fundamentally flawed. Now, my expectation then was that science as practiced by Christians should look very different from science practiced by unbelievers. And thankfully, upon coming to graduate school in San Diego, I began worshiping at a church that gave me a theological foundation for why this was not necessarily so. The pastor taught that because all people are made in the image of God, we can expect everyone to reflect God's truth and goodness to some extent. And also, just as he causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good, God dispenses incredible gifts and skills of intellect on all kinds of people to bless the whole human family. And we often hear the phrase, all truth is God's truth, and are rightly reminded that all knowledge and wisdom come from above. But the larger context of Augustine's exhortation actually centers on this idea of common grace. A person who is a good and true Christian, he writes, should realize that truth belongs to his Lord, wherever it is found, gathering and acknowledging it even in pagan literature. These doctrines of the image of God and common grace helped me to see that my non-Christian scientific colleagues in a humbler and gentler light. Despite our different worldviews, we were seeking and finding a real form of truth. Now, I still had this other concern, which was that while I could see God's purposeful hand in what I was studying, it didn't translate into my science in a way that clearly differed from my secular colleagues. I saw God's creation when I looked in the microscope. I praised him for it. I even tentatively had some water cooler conversations with my colleagues about it. But at the end of the day, how could I glorify God if he wasn't allowed as an explanation for the things I was studying? It felt contrived and dishonest to act as if God didn't exist when I was at work, when I sensed so strongly the opposite, and yet that seemed to be the default assumption in the scientific community. Now, relief came, as I said, when I learned to distinguish between philosophical naturalism and methodological naturalism. And what I discovered was that not appealing to God in science is not the same as denying his activity in the world. Far from it. Accepting that science is only equipped to study a subset of reality, that which is accessible to empirical investigation, is very different from asserting that everything that exists has come about by purely material causes. Furthermore, the Bible reveals a God who normally accomplishes his purposes through means, such as natural processes or human activity. His sovereignty and rational character give strong support for believing that creation operates primarily by regular principles that can be discovered through science. A robust Christian theism sees science as a systematic way of discovering God's means of creating and sustaining the natural world. In this light, the entire scientific enterprise brings God glory because it illuminates one of the two books of Revelation he gave us, the book of nature. Also, because God is the author of all things, we need not worry that discovering natural mechanisms will in any way diminish his creativity and glory. As history has shown, appealing to non-natural explanations within science for phenomena we can't explain tends to short-circuit discovery and give the distinct impression that God is only at work in areas of mystery. Appealing to natural explanations in science, on the other hand, helps us to better appreciate those non-natural explanations arising from other disciplines or from everyday life. For example, I'm expecting a baby next January, and I see God's hand and purpose at work, even as I marvel at the perfectly natural details of the developmental process. So I think rather than thinking about causation as a zero-sum game, where teleological and mechanistic explanations are in competition with one another, we can view them as a complementary accounts of reality. Methodological naturalism, then, backed by an understanding of the doctrine of creation, is for the Christian a theologically motivated practice. It also has the practical benefit of allowing people of diverse worldviews to discover the workings of God's creation, whether or not they acknowledge it as such. In my reading on this topic, I've noticed that the distinction between methodological and philosophical naturalism turns up most frequently in discussions of science and Christianity. In his impressive volume, Darwin's Pious Idea, Christian philosopher Connor Cunningham makes it in the first sentence of his more than 100-page chapter on naturalism, declaring methodological naturalism to be eminently sensible and philosophical naturalism to be the liquidation of existence itself. Scientism, the closely related philosophical position that science is the only begetter of truth, is, according to Cunningham, a massive intellectual pathology. Now, C.S. Lewis illustrates the difference between these two positions in his characteristically colorful style. Science, he says, works by experiments. It watches how things behave. Every scientific statement in the long run, however complicated it looks, really means something like, I pointed the telescope to such and such a part of the sky at 2:20 a.m. on January 15th and saw so-and-so. Do not think I'm saying anything against science. I'm only saying what its job is. But why anything comes to be there at all, and whether there's anything behind the things science observes, something of a different kind, that is not a scientific question. Now, of course, there's much more to science than simple observation, but here Lewis correctly points out that science is limited in the kinds of questions it can answer. Confusion often comes about when we fail to recognize whether a given question is best answered by science or philosophy. Modern science emerged in the Christian West, as we have heard today, and historians have demonstrated that the biblical worldview was an important factor in its development. Methodological naturalism was encouraged by devout natural philosophers such as Francis Bacon, Robert Boyle, and Isaac Newton, and the practice continues to be defended by Christian scientists today. The ID community tells a different story, however. In a primer about intelligent design, William Dembski and Jonathan Witt argue that methodological materialism, which is their term for methodological naturalism, is inherently atheistic. In their view, it represents a marketing strategy for Darwinist ideology. They write, Only one in ten Americans is an out-and-out atheist, but atheists have managed to extend their influence by selling religious people a related idea called methodological materialism. In its most ambitious form, methodological materialism says that we can believe whatever we want in our personal life, but when we're doing serious academic work, we should only consider and defend explanations fully consistent with philosophical naturalism. Now, this view of methodological naturalism as a backdoor to atheism and moral relativism represents a clear departure from the traditional view and is curious given the sizable number of scientists who accept the convention and yet enjoy an abiding faith. While not all ID advocates make this argument, it has been observed that the center of gravity of the ID movement is a rejection of methodological naturalism. In his book Signature in the Cell, ID theorist Stephen Meyer argues that methodological naturalism is a restrictive and arbitrary standard in science. In 2005, Judge John E. Jones ruled in the famous Dover, Pennsylvania trial that intelligent design theory isn't science. Now, seeking to demonstrate why the ruling was wrong, Meyer writes that Judge Jones rejected ideas science because of methodological naturalism. According to Jones's definition, which Meyer relegates to a footnote, methodological naturalism is, and I quote, the self-imposed convention of science which limits inquiry to testable natural explanations about the natural world, end of quote. In other words, the standard definition, no supernatural explanations allowed. But Meyer argues against Jones by using a subtly different definition. He writes, and I quote, methodological naturalism asserts that to qualify as science, as scientific, a theory must explain all phenomena by reference to purely material, that is, non-intelligent causes. And he goes on, a theory must explain, as Nancy Murphy explains, methodological naturalism forbids reference to creative intelligence in scientific theories. End of quote. Here, all intelligent causes, including natural ones, are outside the bounds of science. Meyer then concludes that Jones's reasoning is circular. He says, intelligent design isn't science because it violates the principles of methodological naturalism. What is methodological naturalism? A rule prohibiting consideration of intelligent design in science. In other words, ID isn't science because of an arbitrary rule. Now, numerous fields of scientific study look for or study the signs of intelligence. Archaeology uses cultural artifacts to reconstruct past human activity. Forensic science examines evidence left at a crime scene to determine who is responsible. And the SETI project looks for alien communication from outer space. If these endeavors don't count as science according to methodological naturalism, as Meyer argues, then methodological naturalism must be too restrictive a criterion for what constitutes science. It's easily seen, however, that these fields do abide by the traditional definition of methodological naturalism, which only excludes supernatural explanations, not all intelligent causes. Importantly, Meyer's arguments against methodological naturalism work by redefining it. He does not adhere to the traditional descriptions articulated by Judge Jones or even by Nancy Murphy, whom he cites in his own definition. In the original context, Murphy's phrase, creative intelligence, clearly refers to a transcendent supernatural being, not to just any intelligent cause. Very few scientists and scholars would agree with Meyer that science tries to explain all phenomena by reference to strictly non-intelligent causes. The true disagreement is over whether supernatural causation can be identified using the methods of science. As can be seen in many of the writings, ID theorists believe that modern science is fundamentally flawed. In their view, we ought not to assume that all natural phenomena have a natural explanation. And certainly, as a Christian who believes that God sometimes chooses to work outside of his regular chosen means of ordering the world, I agree. I question whether science is equipped to investigate miracles, but not that they occur. Miracles just simply appear to be in the blind spot of science. Now, many have framed this concept of methodological naturalism as meaning that when scientists go to work, they either pretend God doesn't exist or that he isn't doing anything in the physical world. For example, William Dembski and Jonathan Witt, whom I quoted earlier, write, methodological naturalism affirms not so much that God does not exist as that God need not exist. Its message is not that God is dead, but rather that God is absent. And because God is absent, intellectual honesty demands that we get about our work without invoking him. Now, clearly, if this is how people understand the practice, as I confess I once did, there is justifiable concern. No Christian, even for professional reasons, can or should proceed this way, for to do so would quickly lead to a deistic or even atheistic perspective. This mistaken formulation is no doubt due in part to the word naturalism. Biologist scholar Dennis Alexander argues that methodological naturalism is perfectly sensible as a practice, but as a term it can easily be confused with philosophical naturalism. He writes, we don't call Christian accountants naturalistic because of the absence of theological terminology as they check the company accounts, any more than we expect our doctor to use theological language when she tells us we've got the flu. The absence of specific references to God does not render our lives suddenly naturalistic. Alexander suggests we drop the term methodological naturalism and simply talk about scientific explanations instead. And while this seems like wise counsel, it's hard to imagine that eliminating the term would resolve all problems, since the meaning of science itself has proven so difficult to define. For scientists to consciously glorify God in the practice of methodological naturalism, I believe they must have a full-bodied embrace of the doctrine of creation. And for lack of time, I won't expand on that here, but Robert's given us a good start, and I would recommend a helpful essay on the BioLogos website that he wrote. He points out that contemporary Christians usually only have a very atrophied version of the doctrine in mind when they think about creation, God's work in creation, and science. Now, Michael Peterson calls methodological naturalism the idea that we should view science as a certain epistemological portal that we have refined over time and through which people of different religions, philosophies, and moral theories can make progress explaining natural phenomena by reference to natural causes. At the beginning of my talk, I touched on my own pleasant experience of the communal nature and truth-generating power of science, despite the diverse worldview of my lab mates. Unfortunately, these dual aspects of science have contributed to a serious problem. The fact that science is so successful, irrespective of one's religious persuasion, has led to the perception that science is about facts, while faith is a mere matter of opinion. As illogical as this is, many have concluded that science is the basis of all true knowledge, again, this idea of scientism, and that it may even represent a solid new foundation for civil society. Now, lest we hold science itself responsible for this unfortunate development, we should remember that it's the good and noble things in life that make for the most seductive idols. The fact that many in our age have worshipped at the throne of scientific progress does not mean that this practice of science itself is deeply flawed. As a scientist, I see the collaborative success of science to be among the strongest pragmatic arguments for methodological naturalism. It just works. Now, methodological naturalism also spurs us on towards deeper investigation of the natural world. What journal would accept a paper where the author argued that stars formed from the spirits of our ancestors, or that a tricky step in a chemical reaction proceeds by the help of angels? Now, these examples are silly, but the history of science is rife with examples of now understood phenomena that were once attributed to the divine. With each new discovery, God's sphere of activity seemed to shrink. And while it may be argued that this concern does not merit a full prohibition against appeals to supernatural causation, it does seem that such examples have occurred frequently enough to cast doubt that God is ever a good explanation. Now, recognizing God's goodness over all of creation, whether we understand it or not, helps us avoid the temptation to invoke his direct action for some particular phenomena. Similarly, methodological naturalism prevents us from demeaning God by pitting him against his own creation. If it's either God or nature, we run the risk of bringing God down to the level of a second cause, like photosynthesis or gravity. This way of thinking also tends to diminish God's regular sustaining activity of those parts of nature we do understand. Methodological naturalism, paradoxically, helps us to appreciate perfectly legitimate non-scientific explanations. For example, a farmer can consider a rainstorm as an answer to prayer without rejecting the meteorological explanation for why it occurred. Causation, again, is not a zero-sum game. Methodological naturalism further prevents us from trying to use science to answer ultimate, worldview-type questions. Though it ably answers the how questions, science will always fail to provide the why questions. And how many times have we heard new atheists declare that science eliminates the need to believe in God? Equally disastrous are those attempts by well-meaning Christians to prove God's existence using science. Both sides give too much authority to science and fall prey to scientism. Methodological naturalism is a sensible safeguard against such worldview creep. Finally, coming back to a practical argument, science depends on empirical evidence and testing. Since God, or the intelligent designer, as the ID community would say, is free and unpredictable, virtually any empirical observation could be the result of design. So how do we test hypotheses if we can't make predictions? Well, one way, as the ID community argues, is to compare them to all the other naturalistic explanations and infer the best one based on causal explanation. Now, if design has more explanatory power than the others, it should be accepted as an inference to the best explanation. The problem, of course, is that the correct hypothesis may not yet be on the table. So in conclusion, I hope I've succeeded in explaining why, far from leading down a slippery slope to deism or atheism, Methodological naturalism is a wise practice for Christians. Limiting science to natural explanations may not successfully uncover all the causes at work within our world. This should not trouble us in the least. After all, it isn't the job of science to provide a comprehensive view of reality. Methodological naturalism, along with the doctrine of creation, gives us freedom to explore God's regular means of creating and sustaining the natural world. In doing so, we can bring our Creator greater glory and praise. Thank you.